Hey, I have a question. Why is the prize of the master is a jacket?
And green
And
too. Like,
green.
here we go.
The golf
Here
green.
we go.
The legit good question that I don't have the answer to, and there probably is a real answer, actually.
Yeah, there probably is.
Yeah.
Hard to sleep with the actual green
Probably
jacket.
goes hundreds of years.
This is gonna be a good one. So, five,
Four,
three,
two,
and
one.
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 Hello, world, hear the song that we're singing. Come on, get happy.
Ladies and gentlemen, mesdames, messieurs, bienvenue, welcome to the happy hour.
Welcome back, listeners. We have a great episode in store for you this week. I mean, last week we recorded on Monday, and what happened Tuesday? A catastrophe. My name is David Ogier, and I'm at MetalDave02 on Twitter.com, joined, as always, and thankfully, by Beth, who could make it.
Hello.
Hey,
Surprise,
awesome.
surprise. I'm at HIVERHYT on Twitter.
And Veronica.
I'm at CHILE underscore Pepper on Twitter.
And for those on YouTube, you can see that one of our blocks with the heads on it are blurred out, and that's going to change in a few seconds. We have a guest with us tonight. He is currently in his 13th season on the Montreal Canadiens beat, an insider for both the Habs and the NHL at large, and he is a senior columnist at Sportsnet that we found out, thankfully, for some work that he handed us. You can find him on Twitter at Eric Engels. We have none other than Eric Engels. Welcome to the podcast, Eric.
Got to update that bio. It's actually my 14th season. Gave great
Whoa!
praise for rookies the same year.
I got that bio from Sportsnet.
Dear
It's been a
Sportsnet.
busy year, you know, we're a little behind.
Yeah.
No, certainly so. So, Eric, you had mentioned to us over the weekend that you put together an article, and it's one of your Canadiens mailbags, and it had some really interesting questions. One of which kind of came to at least halfway to fruition today with the line changes that you were talking about. One of the Twitter people had asked you about line changes, your opinions on it, and we saw today that two of your lines came to be a reality. We have Drouin, Suzuki, and Anderson as the top line so far, and then we have the really interesting one, I think, Kotkaniemi with Toffoli and Gallagher. Can you talk about that with us, please?
Sure, what do you want to know?
Well, of
We
all the
ask
things.
questions in the media. I need an actual question to answer.
Oh, well, geez. Well, why KK and Gallagher?
I mean, I think the answer would be that I don't think it's as simple as just Kotkaniemi and Gallagher and their specific roles to it. I think it's also that Josh Anderson had a great chemistry with Suzuki and Drouin, and you know, ideally they were looking for the best balance they could have, and putting Armia next to Drouin and Suzuki, a line that worked pretty well in the playoff bubble, and perhaps you know, give Kotkaniemi a chance with two of the best scorers on the team, and you get a kind of that balanced approach with the Danault line staying intact. But you know, I think Anderson has played his best next to Suzuki and Drouin, and Armia didn't take advantage of that opportunity that he was given. And Gallagher, you know, is producing scoring chances, and the line with Danault and Tatar certainly looked a lot better. But you know, it's an opportunity for Kotkaniemi to maintain playing with two good scoring wingers, and maybe they achieve the balance they're looking for within these three lines. Ducharme said when he first made his line changes on Saturday, when I actually wrote that column, the first changes he made that we were just discussing, he said that he might move around the right wingers as things go along. I had anticipated that it would probably go this way. You know, you're not going to keep Anderson away from Drouin and Suzuki for too long, given how good that line has been this season. I think his hope was that Armia would just really reach into his bag of tricks and his potential and take advantage of that situation, and it didn't really happen. So he's got to, you know, when they play a game like they did on Monday against Vancouver, and they create great scoring chances and only end up with one goal and lose 2-1 in overtime or a shootout, you know, you gotta mix it up a little bit. And it seems as though the stuff is kind of the stuff that they're trying to incorporate in their game has taken hold. So I think he feels comfortable tweaking things more often now.
One of the things I was wondering about that is with the games on Saturday, the blowout, right, Saturday against Winnipeg and then the game against Vancouver, what's your thoughts on Suzuki's play? Is he playing up to his potential, or do you think he's kind of sliding along right now?
I don't think it's a question of him sliding along, and as far as his potential is concerned, I think it's going to be maximized more so with Anderson than it would be with Armia, especially with the way Drouin is playing in the last few games. But, you know, I was guilty as anybody for kind of anointing Suzuki an established number one center. I think early on in the season, I had even tweeted that it looks as though he's there, you know, at six games in a row, he's producing a point a game. And it's just because I've come to know Nick Suzuki quite well and really do believe that he's such a mature person. And even Claude Julien was talking at the beginning of the year about how they're not at all concerned about a sophomore slump or anything like that. And neither was I, because it's just the natural progression in which he came into the league. You know, they sent him down to junior for another year, and just his maturity and the way he approaches things. And the other thing about that I learned about Suzuki and being around him is that he has this Canadiana kind of value about him, about being such this humble, quiet kind of kid. But what's very obvious the more you hang around him is that he knows exactly how good he is. And so I just felt that also the two breaks, the extended breaks in the schedule from, you know, things shutting down and then them going to the bubble last year to the bubble ending and them having until January this year, we're going to help him physically. And I'm not referring to whatever's happened with him so far this year at all as a sophomore jinx or anything like that. But you got to remember, he's 21 years old, and there will be periods where it's catching up to him a little. He's also playing about 20 minutes a game, and it's a physically demanding thing to do. And you know, it's just, I think there's some growing pains involved in that, but I also there's too much good in his game to be overly concerned about him going 4 or 5 games without scoring or going through a 10 game stint where it's not coming as easily as it normally does for him.
Right. Cool.
I believe it was during, the beginning of the play-ins or towards the end of, towards the pause. Last season, Veronica mentioned on one of our shows that she believes that a lot of times players have a sophomore slump because coaches now know what to look for with those players because they've been able to watch them for half a season or a whole season. Do you think that could be something impacting Suzuki's production or play, or is it just more of a growing pains problem?
Yeah, it's a little bit of everything, right? I mean, the coaches do figure you out to a certain degree, and they inform their players on what your tendencies are and how you operate. But also, you know, there are more and more players themselves who understand what Suzuki's potential is and know that he's a player that could be dangerous on the ice. He's a very smart player. He's been called a cerebral player by not just me, but several other people. And, you know, that the players that play against him will know him better than just about anybody else. And in a division now where you are playing the same opponent 2-3 times in a row and you're playing them 10 times in a season, you have that much more time to scout their tendencies and do things that disrupt their ability to play. And like, some teams in this division are really good at it. You know, Montreal, if you look at the way they've handled Draisaitl and McDavid this year, how they've handled Matthews for the most part, and even Marner to a degree, and even Pettersson, you know, it's clear that they've done a great job on the pre-scout, but also that their players themselves have really taken the assignments the right way. And the opportunity to play against the same player 2-3 times in a row, you start to develop a game plan and a way of playing as a 5-man unit against that player. And Suzuki, because he is a good player and one of the most dangerous ones on this team, is getting that type of attention from some of the best players in the world right now. And that's what I mean when I say growing pains. That's something that he just can't prepare for. It's something he just needs to go through and experience. But the other thing about Suzuki, which we know, is that his potential is, and his ability is there. So he's going to find ways to navigate that and come out on the other side of it and probably emerge as an even better player than the one who started the year when things get a little bit more important or a little more heated. You know, he's just got to live those experiences. And, you know, it might take him a couple more years to really be the player that I thought, okay, like, wow, he's even ahead of where I thought he was when I tweeted that 6 games into the season. It might take him a couple years to actually get to that level where he consistently can be called a point per game guy and going up against the best players in the world night in, night out, and not feel the effects of it. Everybody goes through 3-4 games where they don't, you know, but he has that ability, and I don't see anything in his play, even when he hasn't been producing as much as people expect, that would suggest that he's off that course. I think he's very much on that course.
Nice. Do you think, Eric, do you think that there's anything to what Mark Brisbane says? I think there is something to what he says, but is it like just that, like some players get you there, some players get you through, or, you know, get you there, get you through, whatever the saying is, because
in relation to Suzuki or in...
with reference to Suzuki, like last year, we saw what he did in the bubble after he struggled. He did struggle last season, towards the end of last season. Then we saw what he did in the bubble. And then we saw what he did with his team on that Memorial Cup run. Like, I wonder if he just flips a switch when it counts not if he flips a switch, but a switch flips when it counts.
I think Suzuki's both.
Yeah.
You know, I think he's just, this is just a classic case of a young player finding his way in the NHL and a young player who has such high potential and that ability. I don't believe this is a question of a certain level of intensity that needs to be conjured at a time where things are not quite as intense as they would be in the playoffs. I think one of the reasons why Suzuki was so good in the bubble was A, because he was refreshed, which is big, but B, he's the type of player that the tighter the game gets, because of his skill set and his ability to read things and his mentality, because it's such a mental game at that level, you know, his best stuff tends to shine through when it's on the line. And I don't think it's because he's, you know, the general terms of, oh, he's raising his play or he's raising his level, like guys do that, and that makes sense. Yeah. But I'm more thinking about like what's behind that and why that happens. And I think it's because the simpler the game gets, a player who thinks in 3-dimension and has the intensity, because Nick Suzuki, one of the things about him that people may not realize just seeing his personality, and this is that, and just how calm and kind of quiet and humble he is, he's a very intense player. He is a player that the very first thing I ever wrote about Nick Suzuki actually was in a rookie camp where I walked up to him and said, you know, some scouts have questioned whether or not you have the intensity or the compete level to match the skill and this and that. And I think it's based on the fact that they don't see you playing at 100 miles an hour in a game that moves now at 100 miles an hour. And I remember him saying, well, that's a misconception, because I'm extremely intense and I may not move at 100 miles an hour, but I think that way. And it's because I'm not looking to just do what everybody else does on the ice. I'm looking to do what I think is the best thing and what I know is the best thing. And I'm probably butchering what his actual quotes were, but it is a kind of a paraphrased version of him believing in himself and what he is and knowing exactly how intense he is. And I think we've seen samples of that all the way along. It's just when he's kind of hit the wall or not produced at the level for a stint of games that people expect of him because of what his skill is and his ability is. It's just because it's the hardest league in the world. Like, it's the hardest league in the world, and he's playing against the best players and he's 21 years old. Yeah. He's just going to go through it.
Rock on. We're very pro Suzuki on this podcast.
Very pro Suzuki, even though I
believe you guys are very pro everyone on this podcast. I'm sure you are.
Sometimes, but, you know.
It doesn't mean Suzuki's perfect either, you know? Like, there's parts of this game that he'll need to improve in that process. He'll need to find a way to consistently play at the same level game after game and deal with the fact that he's a center of attention out there. And he needs help too from his line mates, which I think, you know, he's certainly getting from Drouin in terms of the way he's driving the play, and Anderson, the way he plays is a blessing for both those guys.
Oh God.
Yeah. So, very lucky. So.
Very Columbus lucky. Is missing Anderson right about now.
Columbus is missing a lot of things right about now.
Yeah.
They're back to being one.
Trading away Pierre-Luc Dubois was a killer. And,
oh, yeah. Shit.
You know, Max Domi is – I don't know how people view Max Domi. I know what Max Domi is. And if he's used the right way, he's a very productive player. But, you know, it's been hard for him there, obviously. Hasn't adjusted as well as he would like to. They just have issues there in terms of the support that you would need. And, you know, the one thing about Max is an incredible rush player.
Yeah.
And the system in Columbus needs to be tuned for that to come out a little bit more, I think. And to me, there's no question about where he's best on the ice. It's at center. But if he has to be one of your top two without much insulation, which he doesn't have outside of Jack Roslovich right now, it's the warts kind of come out and shine. And that's, you know, that's, he's not a perfect player, and there are very few players that would qualify as perfect ones. So
for sure. So yeah. We've been talking a lot about forwards, you know, along the same lines in the article there in the mailbag, you talk about defense. Habs, today the lines came out same lines. And of course, people are head hunting for poor Sherratt, because of how things transpired at the last game. What are your thoughts about the Habs so far keeping the D together, even though some say split up the top pairing?
Well, before I get into it, I just want to say that the goal that got scored by Adam Gaudette was not purely on Sherratt.
No, right.
The first mistake on the play, you know, when we asked Dominic Ducharme about, or it was Arpin Basu who asked Dominic Ducharme about it after the game, and he said, where do you see the mistake happen on that goal? And Ducharme pointed to an over-aggressive play in the neutral zone. And what happened was is that Jonathan Drouin was the F1 in the situation, and he went to go pursue the puck, which was on Quinn Hughes' stick. And Josh Anderson was kind of in close support to Drouin, but lost track of his man, who's Bo Horvat on the play. And when that happened and Anderson got caught in no man's land, Deneau left where Gaudette was to go cover because Horvat was so wide open in a place where he could be dangerous and make a play. And Sherratt was in the right position, but didn't react fast enough to obviously cover where Deneau was coming for and make the switch. It just happened. So it's easy to break down after the fact.
Yeah.
Low motion, but in real speed, all that happens within a split second. And, perfect shot by God.
Oh, God.
Mm-hmm.
I'm so tired. I was on Vancouver radio today. Oh. And I'm so, so tired of people not giving shooters credit for goals that they score. Like, if you know anything about Adam Gaudette, he was a absolute sniper at Northeastern. He may have gone a month without scoring a goal, but if he gets a chance, like the one he got last night, where he can pull into the circle and take a half slap shot and pick his spot, he's going to score, whether it's Carey Price or Andrei Vasilevsky or anybody else in the net. And if the goalie makes a save, it's an incredible save. And I'm not going to defend a goalie or this. I just find that there's a thing now where, like, if a shot is unscreened and it hasn't been tipped, it's automatically, it should be stopped. And like, we just, it's annoying to me. Like, we give credit to the shooters in the NHL who are literally, like, a guy like Gaudette is literally, that's how he made it to the NHL, was taking the shot that he just took. So anyways, all to say, I don't blame Sherratt for that goal. I do think he could play better. We've seen better from him, you know, certainly last year and portions of this year. As far as the pairings and staying together, you know, I was when I was asked to kind of build lines and why I would build them and explain to people why I felt that, you know, you could potentially benefit from mixing all three of them. That Kulak would benefit from a bump up with Petrie, where they had good chemistry and their stability there. That Weber, who, let's face it, has not been on top of his game for a good portion of the seasons this year, or a good portion of the games this season, he could benefit from kind of the youth and the movement of Romanov, and Romanov could benefit from him. But it would mean a bit of a reduced role for both of them, because it's pretty hard to expose Romanov, no matter how good he looks, to a situation where he's playing against the best players night in, night out. But Jeff Petrie could take on a bit more ice time, and Sherrod and Edmondson could kind of have that Bash Brothers dynamic that they look to have with Weber and Sherrod to begin with. But the reasons it didn't change was I think, and it hasn't changed, is because Sherrod and Weber are comfortable with each other. Petrie and Edmondson have found comfort with each other. And Romanov is not in a place where they want to expose him too much. They'd like to shelter him. And I think they're being wise about doing that, because even when you see Romanov, I don't think Romanov doesn't have a panic level. Like, no. When there's three guys around him, he's not jumpy. He's not looking to get rid of the puck immediately. He's not scared out there, but he is overactive. His positioning is a little bit wonky. He does tend to complicate the play a little bit too much at times, instead of just making the simple one, even if it means banking it off the boards or the glass and not having a direct pass come through. He also has the poise to throw great passes up the ice like we've seen. So there's a lot of good there. It's just, there's a lot of, he's a 20-year-old kid there. So, and a kid who doesn't have full command of the English language and can't possibly understand everything that's coming his way, but is adjusting extremely well and has certainly found his place within the lineup. But there's times where him and Kulak together, they complicate things, both of them in their own right. So I just felt like maybe you could change something here. I also think that in not changing something, we're going to see, and we haven't seen enough of a sample, but if I look over five games, I would anticipate that we're going to see Weber and Sherratt's ice time drop a good amount, and we're going to take on more. I think Petrie played about 27 minutes last night, which was at least, I think, 5 minutes more than anybody else on the blue line. And that's probably what you want to do, given the way Petrie's playing right now. So we could see some changes there. I don't know that any of them are imminent, but I think we're going to see some changes in the way they use the guys.
It always comes out whenever Shea Weber is underperforming that he's hurt. Because it's not like he forgot how to play hockey. And it's not like he's, I don't know. It always comes out that he's hurt. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised, but you're right. He's been underperforming, and Petrie has been on fire. And if they need less time, that makes a lot of sense. But splitting them up, it's kind of like a cheap solution, I think. It hasn't happened yet.
You got to look for solutions. You know, if Sherrod and Weber are going to be on the ice for the majority of the goals against, you have to start to think about it as something that you want to kind of tweak, make a change to. As far as Weber's concerned and his performance, you know, one of the issues that I have in the evaluation of Weber is that it's very easy to point out what he's not doing well at times, but you often miss what he does well and the little things that he does. There's the other thing about him being hurt and everything. If we were around and in the rooms and I could go and talk to Weber and kind of figure out what's going on, I would tell you right now that he would never admit to anyone about being less than 100%. But I also know Weber, and I know about the lingering injuries he's had over the last 3 years, and there's more than one of them. And I'm sure that's part of the reason why he at times has not been at his best. But I also, you know, he would not be playing if he wasn't able to play. And I think he'd be the first to say that he can play better. And I think he's, you know, like I said, there's things that he does and has done well that people don't recognize when they see him flub a puck on the power play or not make a crisp pass or whatever it is. There's a lot of little things that he does on the ice that still make him as effective as he is. And he's also 35 years old. And like, it's just, he's not a player that at this stage of his career, regardless of how reliable he is, that should always be the de facto. He's going to play against the best players every night and play 25 minutes a game. And it's not the best way to use him. And the truth is, like, if you watch the way he played in the bubble last year, he was phenomenal. Like, he was so miserable to play against, him and Sherratt together. And I think they need to preserve that for when they do get to the playoffs, and there's ways to do it. And if it means splitting them up for a few games and putting them back together when you play against McDavid and Draisaitl or whatever it is, you know, it's, there's ways to do it. And I think Shea, if you watch the way Shea plays, the chances that he's playing with something, a bump or bruise or an injury, is pretty much higher than it is that he's not.
Yeah.
But he's not going to use it as an excuse. And that's one of the reasons why
I respect
Shea a lot.
Yeah. Well, it's because it's only pain, according to Shea.
The only pain, that's his quote.
Only pain. Did you have anything about that, Beth?
I don't know. So, I mean, Ducharme did say that he wasn't going to change everything all at once, which I absolutely respect, understand, agree with. It's just, like, I've never played ice hockey. I've never been a coach or anything. It's just, sometimes it seems like the forward lines are the easy pieces to move around. It's like, it's an interchange. It's a Lego set. Like, oh, you can change these bricks around and make something different with them. And like, yeah, the forward lines are always being shuffled around no matter what team you're talking about. It happens, but it seems like a lot of times with the Canadians in general that the defensive pairings are a lot less malleable in the eyes of the coach. And so I think this long-term stasis is frustrating for fans because they see potential solutions, and fans are not in the room. They're not in practices. So no, we don't know exactly what's being said or what's going on. But like Eric said, like you said, you have to look for solutions. And so when there is one visible, it gets frustrating when it feels like it's not being taken into consideration, but for all we know, it could be enough.
Well, I think they're always looking for different things to do, but at the same time, there is a certain, you hit on something that's actually true, that Ducharme even mentioned himself, that it's easier to change around the forwards than it is the defense. And one of the reasons is that the roles are so different from pairing to pairing, and the dynamic and chemistry that builds between a pairing is not something that happens instantaneously just because you plug somebody in with someone who is a good fit. It takes a long time to understand the tendencies, in playing defense and reading off your partner and communicating and knowing exactly what they're going to do. One of the key things about being a good partnership on defense is a predictability factor. When I speak to Ben Sherratt about playing with Shea, he knows, fans might get frustrated about a pass that Shea makes or the fact that he doesn't get to a puck fast enough or whatever it is. But Ben knows exactly what Shea is going to do when the puck is coming down his side and how he's going to erase it and how he's going to move it and where he's going to move it to and how he plays the percentages. Romanov might be a great fit with Weber in terms of the fact that Romanov has this mobility and this puck moving ability that is not deficient for Shea, but it's not exactly his best asset. I still think he's really good at it and even underrated at it, but just because they're a good fit with each other, just because Weber's experience is a good fit next to Romanov's inexperience, doesn't mean that they'll be on the same page fast enough with the crunch and the time crunch that they're in and the fact that they don't have practice time. And, it's really complicated, and it's not the same as forward lines. And forward lines, you know, there is a certain uniqueness to each forward line in terms of the way they play, and Ducharme is certainly treating it that way. But at the same time, there is a kind of a rule of law in terms of how they're supposed to play and where they're supposed to go and where they're supposed to be on the ice, that, and there's a certain compatibility in moving pieces from one line to the next in terms of having similar assets to move and mix and match. I think it's way easier to make a move where you, like on defense, where you have just Edmondson and Kulak switch spots than it would be if you mixed all three of your pairings, like I had suggested in that column. So, yeah, you know, it's complicated. It doesn't mean that it should never happen. And I just think you're right in one respect that Ducharme did say he doesn't want to just switch everything right now, and that it is easier to play around with your forwards than it is your defense. So we'll see what happens. They're doing much in the defensive end right now, so I don't think it's an area that they're particular. You know, one of the big reasons why fans were frustrated with what they were seeing from the defense had a lot to do with the support from the forwards, mm-hmm. the way they were playing kind of loosely. And the game against Vancouver, I know people loved the 7-1 win that Montreal had over Winnipeg, but the way they played against Vancouver in a 2-1 loss was, you know, 10 times better in terms of how they supported on the back check and on the forecheck and how they were kind of making themselves available and skating without the puck. It was so much better about that performance than what we saw against Winnipeg, especially in the first like 10, 15 minutes of that game. So,
and also for Vancouver, all credit to Demko, because he was lights out, honestly. So could have been a completely different game.
That was Carey Price.
Yeah, and that's the thing. It was a goalie duel for the ages, as one would say.
It was maybe. Fun. It was we fun. Mentioned that a few weeks ago, that those low-scoring games can be just as exciting to watch as the high-scoring mm-hmm. games, or as fun to watch. But so, Eric.
Uh-oh.
It's been a week since Stefan Waite was relieved of his duties in the middle of a hockey game that the Habs were winning and Carey Price was on the ice. And so I want to get back to the fallout, all of the fallout of that after. By the
way, I was wondering, I'm like, we haven't even asked a question yet. But this is the one Veronica's really up in arms about. And I think it's super interesting. So go for it, Veronica. Yeah.
So what do you, first of all, what do you think of, you know, with all of the coaching changes, it seems to me that whatever was ailing the team has ceased to ail the team. And why do you think Waite was let go, not with the other coaches, but a week later and in the middle of a hockey game? And it is like, when's the last time that happened? Coach wise.
I don't know. I don't have an example to cite, but Mark Bergevin, I thought, was extremely honest about why he did what he did and when he did it and what the reasoning was that it was done at the time that it was done. I'm not going to get into the minutia of that because he explained it. And I actually do believe him to be extremely genuine in the way he explained it. The other thing that was clear to me is that I think the whole situation with Carey left Mark wondering to himself why it was that this trend of him playing okay for the first month and horrible for the second month persisted for, you know, 3 years. Like, it's at a certain point you say to yourself, okay, you know, the trend also includes him turning it around and being one of the top five goalies in the league for the rest of the season. That's been the trend every year. So why those first couple months, and what is it that it takes a month to get him out of it every time?
Yeah.
And I think the answer is kind of twofold. One is that It almost always coincides with the team playing like shit in front of them, which is not a good thing. It's when, and every goalie in the league now goes through it. Like last year, Freddie Anderson was terrible in February for Toronto. But the other thing is I watched the games that Toronto was playing and the media was all over Anderson. I mean, they were really all over him and the fans were even worse. And I watched those games and one of the games was an 8-6 game against Carolina. And honestly, like the way the Leafs played in front of Freddie Anderson gave him zero chance to get his legs back underneath him. And we've seen similar things with the Canadians. Like last year in November, I don't want to go too much over last year, but last year in November when Carey really struggled, it's a bad combination that at the same time, the Canadians couldn't score a goal and they were giving up chances that were unbelievable. Like the grade A chances all over the ice. And when a goalie starts to struggle with his confidence, you can stop the snowball or you can add to it. And, you know, I think it's the same situation. The one thing that if you're Mark Bergevin, you have to think about is like Carey Price is under contract for 6 more years. And the move that was made was not only for the urgency of this season, which obviously, you know, I think Stefan Waite told a number of people in the aftermath that, you know, Bergevin specifically told him, I need to get Carey right. And I need that to happen this year. And like, you know, it's important for us to make the playoffs and it's important for me and my job too. I could be the next one. And all that is true. But I also think that it's important moving forward too, and that something needs to change in Carey Price's off season. And I'm not judging Carey for getting away from the game when he leaves, you know, like that's something he has to do. He's got a family, he's got 3 young kids, he's got a life outside of hockey. And it's for him to enjoy it on his time. Absolutely. But something is wrong in terms of what happens between him preparing for the season, him arriving to camp, and him playing the first month and then the second month. There's for that to persist year after year, something needs to change. And I don't know if it's a physical thing. I don't know if it's a mental thing. But the more and more Mark Bergevin thought about it and the more he started to ask these questions to maybe someone like Sean Burke, you know, some other things came back to him from technical elements in Price's game over the last number of years that just hadn't really changed or that had always appeared at these times where he's not playing as well. I think Carey and Stefan were on the path to fixing what was ailing him. But the long-term stuff that I'm talking about is something that has persisted with Stefan there. And so I think that's why Mark said to himself, look, he said he didn't do it to shake up Carey, but to a certain degree, you know, that is the effect. It is to shake up Carey a little bit. And it is to make him realize like, hey, like, I know you'll figure this out and I know you'll find it now. And I know Sean's going to help you do that right now. He's been through that was the other factor, not just in weight. The fact that it is Sean Burke who has had a career and had his ups and downs is the one distinguishing factor between him and Stefan Waite, who did not play in the NHL. And you could say it doesn't matter, whatever, but it does matter. Like, you know, to have someone who's the person you're closest acquainted to, who has been through those things, talking to you is important. And I think the long-term effect, which is probably there well beyond however long Mark Bergevin will be here if things don't work out, is real. You know, like he's gotta make sure that Price does what he does, because Carey Price is not going anywhere. And every year I get these questions from this person and that person, oh, he's gonna go to Seattle and they're gonna trade him. When they signed that deal, they got married, and Carey understood that, and the Canadians understood that, and you know he deserved that deal, he earned it. You don't want to be the GM who, I've heard people say, why did you give him that deal? And this, it's like, that's what you do. You don't really have a choice, but you have the best player available at a given position, and he's available for a contract, and he's yours, and he belongs to you. You don't walk away from him being willing to sign a long-term deal with your team. Did Mark Bergevin want to give him 8 years and $10.5 million and a backloaded contract that's virtually untradeable? No. Did Carey Price earn that with his leverage? Yes. And what? And so what? You become the GM who lets him walk out the door for nothing, or you trade him to a team and he wins the Stanley Cup there, or you finally get a couple pieces in and you're looking for, you end up becoming a contender, and then the last piece you're looking for is the guy you traded away. It's a no-win situation unless the player that you sign performs. And you know what? For the contract that he's making, which he can never live up to no matter how well he plays,
yeah,
he needs to perform better on a more consistent basis, because we know what his ability is. And they've done everything to give him the advantage too, in bringing in Jake Allen and giving him the rest and doing all that stuff. So when Mark Bergevin says it's not to shake up Carey, well, to a degree it is. And clearly, you know, I think the decision to fire Wade, regardless of how it happened and the timing, because Mark explained why it was done and the timing, and it's fully understandable if you know a bit about how this stuff works. It really is about not just the short term, but the long term with Carey Price. And that's, you know, when people say he did this just to save his job, like the one thing about Mark that he said all along is that he would not do things just to save his job. Now, his job is on the line. You know, this season needs to work and Carey Price needs to be good for it to happen. But he didn't just do it for that purpose. He did it because he needs Carey Price to be the Carey Price he expects him to be on a more consistent basis. That's not to say he won't be bad for 3-4 games like any other goalie would, but he can't go 10 in a row where it's not happening. And
yeah,
lose it for an entire month and the team doesn't play well in front of him and he can't be the one that stops the slide for them instead of the other way around. So, so it's a tough situation, but this is how Mark Bergevin felt was the best way to get ahead of it. Now his gamble needs to pay off. Sean mm-hmm. Burke needs to be the right guy for Carey Price. He needs to be able to connect with him in a way that is going to help him continue on the same path that he's been on over the last 3 games. And we're going to find out, because hasn't been in that position very long and he hasn't even been able to get on the ice with him yet.
To that point, I believe
I know that's really long-winded, but
no, it's perfect. You're perfect.
No, that's A-okay. Perfect according to Veronica, A-okay according to me. But so with Mr. Burke, I believe that his quarantine, that should be up, well, next week then. Right? Do we know a specific day when he'll actually be on the ice?
March 19th.
March 19th. So next Friday. Oh, wow. That's a bit of time, huh? Still. Okay. Cool. Beth, did you have anything?
Just that I was not crazily upset about Stefan Waite being let go. Not to say that I have any contempt or dislike of Monsieur Waite, just that, like, Ashley, silent partner of the Happy Hour, said that it makes sense, because, like, even though he wasn't let go at the same time as Julien and Mueller, Stefan Waite has been there through 2 head coaches. He's been with Carey Price for 8 years. And while he's done amazing things with Carey Price, and we as fans have grown to love him and see him at practices and see him working with the goalie tandems that the team has had, it, like Ashley said, it makes sense. Like, if these other 2 coaches' messages have gotten stale and become ineffective, it makes sense that the same thing would happen with Stefan Waite. And I agree with Eric that, yes, even though the intention or the main intention may not have been to shake Carey up, this is going to shake Carey up, not just with the surprise you have a new goalie coach, but with a new perspective and a new perspective. He has a new perspective.
He didn't seem like a guy that was rejecting all this either. You know, I think he sees the value in having a new voice. I think he sees, you know, it definitely caught him way off guard and there's no way that he was asking for it, But at the same time, you know, I'm sure he's, you know, I know Kerry and I know how serious he takes this and how badly he does want to make the difference. And for him to go through this year after year has got to be incredibly frustrating, especially given the fact that him and Steph have been so successful at creating a way to, but that they haven't found a way to pump the brakes on this issue that's happened year after year with him. You know, I think to a degree it's when he gets told that, okay, you're going to have a new voice and we're going to have a new approach and we're not going to change everything, but I think, you know, something's got to happen here. You know, it's not to say that he's pining for it, but clearly he's on board and knows what's at stake. And, you know, Mark Bergevin put it well. He said, nobody knows better than Carey Price when he's not playing the way he wants to play. And he may not come out and say it or look like he cares about this or that, but he does. And he knows better than anybody else, even better than I do. And I know Carey, you know, like I said, we were rookies the same year. I've covered him his entire career. I know what he's about. And I know what he's capable of, too, despite a body that has suffered some serious injuries and broken down to a degree where he has to treat each practice and each game in a different way than he would have when he was 26 years old. But he's, you know, he was phenomenal on Monday in Vancouver. And he's been great the last three games, and he's building towards being that guy that we expect to see on a daily basis. And he can make a huge difference for this team. So they need him to be that guy. That's why this move was made.
So, okay. So we've talked about Stefan Waite. I'm not going to talk about the press tour that he's been giving. So you and I, Eric,
why don't you want to talk about the press tour he's been doing?
Well, because that's not something that I would have done. It's not something that I would have done.
We're not going to talk about it.
I wouldn't have gone out there and told, you know, relayed private conversations or like, I just wouldn't have done it that way. I respect his feelings and I respect, you know, how he wants to do what he's, how he's doing what he's doing. But I personally wouldn't have done that.
But what about him? Have you looked at it from his side?
Oh yeah. That's what I mean. I totally respect his feelings. I totally respect his feelings. Had I been in that position, I would have wanted to do what he's doing.
This is not an embittered press tour he's doing. He's not going out and saying, you know, I deserve this and I deserve that. And he's salvaging his reputation to ensure that he can be employed by somebody else at a future date. He also shed a lot of light on the negativity that came about on Price and people saying that something explosive happened between them, that Price was the reason that he was fired, that Price got him fired. And, you know, he shed light on the fact that.
Yeah, that was good.
Went and visited him. I don't think he said anything particularly wrong. He was extremely graceful in his comments. If you read and listen to the interviews,
I have.
In terms of what he said about Mark Bergevin, in terms of what he said about his own role in Carey's life, about Carey himself. He was honest.
Agreed on all points.
May have been more revealing than you like or Carey would potentially like in terms of the technical elements. But I do think Stefan Waite in this, you know, was really caught off guard after doing, you know, a pretty good job and has a career that he wants to continue and wants people to know that, like, he didn't do anything specific that led to a lot of speculation within the marketplace and could damage his credibility. So
I agree. But he said a couple of things in those interviews that he knows are going to catch fire in Montreal. It, you know, anyway, but agreed on all points on all of the things that he said and sort of shed the light and took fire. Pardon me?
What did he say that's going to catch fire?
When he said that Mark Bergevin fired him to save his own ass.
He didn't exactly put it that way.
I'm paraphrasing.
I think he said it more the way I said it, which is that Mark acknowledged to him that if he didn't do something to get Carey going in the direction that he expects to see him in, that he could be the next guy. I think those were the exact words that Stefan used, and it's not a secret.
It's not a secret. That's what I was saying.
9 years later, you know, like that's where he's at.
Well, and also I don't think that Stefan Waite has to worry about his reputation or his body of work or his, you know, it all precedes him and he's gonna be fine.
Yeah, but there was a rampant speculation about an issue with Price and you know, he's put in a position in losing his job and not having a voice that it's all his fault that Kerry has gone into this situation. I think, to be honest with you, if I were in his position, I would want people to know how he operates. You know, he came across as very humble and full of humility and understanding of the situation. I actually think that, you know, in terms of he's got to take care of himself. And if he had come out and just thrown arrows at everybody, that would have been an ugly look and not something that I would recommend. But in this particular case, I think he came across as with plenty of humility and ownership of the situation. And I don't think he did much damage to Bergevin, Price, or...
Oh, no. It's just that one thing that stuck with me. I thought I wouldn't have given up that part of the that part of a private conversation. I would not have.
But it's less so aimed at Bergevin, more so aimed at defending himself, right? Like he's saying, you know, I didn't do anything outlandish to get myself fired, that the GM came and explained to me in clear terms that if he didn't do something to spark Price, that he wasn't going to take a 1% chance that the work that they were doing together wasn't going to be successful.
Yeah.
That he could be the next guy. That's exactly how Stefan put it. So it wasn't like he fired me just to save his own ass. You know, like he didn't say that. And it didn't come that way. And it didn't catch the fire that you're suggesting it might have. So
but except for on Twitter.
That's all.
You know?
Nope. It's only Twitter.
It just drives me crazy. Okay, so right, but speaking crazy, of
but no
which,
no one cares about that. Just so you know, no one cares.
I think I have the answer to all of this, though. But don't quote me because I'm very bad at citing sources when they matter. So I think wasn't it the Journal de Montréal that had the headline in French? Yes. That I was canned because the boss was trying to save his job, and the whole article was framed around that quote, and that's what looked bad, essentially. And I think that's what reading.
If somebody has that take, it's not an unreasonable take to have, and they wouldn't need, you know, they could use Stefan Waite's words to embolden their own point. I think the fans in general have a good enough sensor and sniffer in terms of like what take is believable or acceptable. And the ones that don't, that's fine. You know, like that's just who they are. You guys are a certain breed of fans. There's other people that are a different breed of fans. Like it's just, that's what it is. You know, like that's what sports is. That's the whole thing, you know? So it's, as long as you're cool with what you buy into and what you think and what you believe in, like, you know, I don't know who would have written that take. I'd love to read it for myself. I didn't even see it. Didn't even know about it.
I think it was J.O. Chamon.
Was it?
I think so.
I'd be very surprised if that's the case.
Now I have to find my source that I cited. This is the worst night of my life.
While Dave finds that, Eric.
Great.
So.
I'm muting. Sorry.
But J.O. Chamon is not a take artist, right? Like he's a news.
Yeah, I think it was a journal.
If he was just taking the quotes and filling them into his piece, but not actually like writing a column, which JF doesn't write a lot of columns, really.
Okay, I don't want to impugn JF Chamon.
Yeah, JF's one of the best.
Yeah, I do. Yeah, I love him. I follow him. Eric. So. It was after Stefan Waite was relieved of his duties and Kerry Price came before the media, you asked him a question and he answered you. And then the whole world set on fire. And then I made a tweet on Twitter to which you took, umbrage. Is that the word?
No, not really. I want you to explain. A lot of people misconstrued what I asked Kerry Price and why I asked him the question.
I have it verbatim here, by the way, if you need it.
Yeah, sure.
Oh, yeah?
If you want to read it verbatim, by all means.
Okay, so what Eric had the gall to ask for Kerry Price at this presser. So, no, this is it. angle is a question of price. In your long experience in your career, we've had a lot of interactions with you. It's changed over the years, where I think you would probably agree the less you say, the better it is for you. But at times, it's also led to the perception that you don't care enough about what you're doing. How do you feel about people taking on that perception? To which Carey Price replied, "It doesn't matter to me anymore." Quite, so, very, very Carey.
Yeah.
So a lot of people, after I asked that question, within the 10 minutes of that press conference ending and me getting to my car, some people went on the radio and were trying to dissect it. And what did he mean? And who's he talking about? Is he talking about the media? Is he talking about people in general? Look, it came to my attention that a lot of people don't understand why we ask certain questions and how we ask certain questions. And in this particular case, I'm pointing out the media interaction specifically because of the fact that for years now, throughout Price's career, people have pointed to the way he deals with media. And I could have just as easily referenced body language on the ice, because that's the other thing that people read into. So if I had actually framed the question and said, you know, I think you would agree in your interactions with us, kind of the less you say, the better it is for you, but it's also led to the perception that you don't care enough. And sometimes your body language on the ice has led to the perception that you don't care enough. If I had added that caveat, those I think are the two things that people constantly dissect and come up with this conclusion, this incredibly lazy, stupid narrative that Carey Price doesn't care enough. And I wrote a column like a couple years ago about how misguided this perception is. And I gave some examples of how much Price cares. And I said in the column, like, as reporters who are there, who have the discretion to keep what happens in the room sometimes in the room, and do that out of respect for someone like Price, like, we've kept it to ourselves when he's cursed at the top of his lungs and kicked over a garbage can and, you know, screaming and doing all kinds of things, you know, to respect his dignity. And these are private moments that happen within the locker room. But to a certain degree, we've done him a bit of a disservice, because in not telling people that those things happen, it doesn't fight against the narrative and the idea, this incredibly stupid and misguided idea that he doesn't care. A guy that doesn't care doesn't drive over to his ex-goaltending coach's house the next day and, you know, make sure that he's okay with everything that happened, and then make it clear that, like, you know, he feels so bad about the situation. And like Carey Price, like I've said a couple times here, I've known him his entire career. I know how much he cares. I know how intense he is. He's a really different person behind the scenes than he is in front of the cameras. And he realized after he made this comment about being a hobbit in a hole in Montreal and not being stopping, that turned into a wildfire, that he decided that a long time ago that he was not going to say anything good or bad when things are going great or things are not going great, because he felt very much damned if he does and damned if he doesn't, and he might as well not. I asked the question to Carey that day for two reasons. One, in Marc Bergevin making his comment about Carey knows when he's not playing well, he knows better than anyone, and he used these words. He said, he may not show you guys that he cares when he talks to you, but he knows. So that got it in my head. That was the first thing. The second reason I asked Carey that question is because I can make the argument that Carey Price cares, but my argument will have a much, much more weight to it if he says himself, of course I care. Like, of course I care. I care more than anyone about my performance, and I want to do as well as possible. And the truth is, it doesn't bother me how these people feel. I only care what my teammates feel. And if he had used the opportunity, I wanted to give him that opportunity to say that, because not just to give him a chance to defend himself against this stupid narrative, but it strengthens my argument if I have his words attached to it. And I always give people that opportunity. And I'll give you an example of it from the other side of it. A few years ago, the Canadians started the season with like 3 losses in a row. They were in Washington and New York, and they got pounded like 6-1 in back-to-back games. And in New York, Jordy Benn was the worst player on the ice. It was like he was horrible in the game. And I asked to speak to him after the game. And PR guy who's very protective of the players and loves the players and wants to protect them as much as possible turned to me and said, "What for? You want to make a bad night shittier for him?"
Yeah.
I said, "No, I want to give him I'm going to criticize him in what I write. But if I don't give him an opportunity to speak for himself, then what, like his word should be attached to it, not just mine, because I know Jordy. And I know that if I turn to Jordy and say, Jordy, obviously what I'm going to write about you tonight is not going to be flattering, but I will be the first one who points out when you turn it around and play the way I know you can." Like, and he had shown that the year before. The year before, he had played great for Montreal, and I had written a ton about how he was really somewhat of a, not a revelation, but playing way, way above expectations. And he knew that about me. And so when he did come out eventually, because I convinced the PR person, hey, you know, I could say whatever I'm going to say, but he may as well have an opportunity to speak to his own play. He came out and he spoke to me, and I turned to him. I said, "Look, I'm not about to write a praiseful argue. Like I'm not about to praise you up and down about the way you played tonight. You were horrible." And
but you don't use that word when you're writing.
No, I don't use that.
It's a big difference from some people.
I don't need to use that word. And
exactly.
And anybody who's, well, I don't think there's anyone who's actually writing on the beat that writes it that way. They don't say he was terrible tonight. No, they give you examples of how they struggled or how they did what they did that wasn't up to par. But I told Jordy that night, I said, "Listen, you want to give me some generic quote about how you know you can be better and you will be? No problem. Or you put it however you want to put it and it's going to run. And whatever I say about you, that you played like shit. But I will be the first guy to point out when you turn around and play well. I want to give you the opportunity to speak for your own play and not just have my words attached to it. Like, who am I?" So the players appreciate that. There is an accountability that they have. Carey can say that it doesn't matter to him anymore how everybody else feels about the perception or anybody who has that perception that he doesn't care. I don't believe that. I do believe that Carey does care. I believe that he cares not only about what he's doing, but he does care that anybody would think that he doesn't care with the pressure that's on him. And he's a quiet and sensitive guy who, no matter how much money he makes to do what he does, has a family and has integrity and has, and I don't think anybody wants to be viewed as someone who's above it and doesn't care when they're sacrificing so much and trying so hard to live up to expectations that are so lofty. That's a really harsh thing to deal with. Like if someone turned to me and said, "I don't think Engels cares that much about what he writes or this and that." And like, I work 24/7. When I'm not working, I'm thinking about my work, and I take so much pride in what I do. And at times it's not, you know, last night, a Monday night, the game ends at one, the media availability ends at 1:25. The game was a 1-0 game for Montreal until 40 seconds left in the game.
Oh my God.
Vancouver win. You know how hard it is for me to write on a 2 a.m. deadline and rip. Yeah. And it's not going to come out and be the best piece I've ever written. And I'm going to think about that.
Yeah.
And if someone were to turn to me after that and say, "Your stuff was okay last night. Okay, fine. I can handle that." If someone says, "Yeah, you clearly don't give a shit about me.
You don't care."
It's not gonna bother me. Like, cause I care more than I didn't stay up until 3:30 in the morning thinking about how I could have made it better if I didn't care. So, you know, whether it's me, whether it's Carey Price, I don't think anybody wants to be told that they're this way or that way. And I also think that, you know, one of the reasons I reached out to Veronica is that a lot of people confuse the people that are on the beat and writing about the team on a daily basis and asking the questions in these media availabilities with people that are not around the team and don't know the players and don't have the interactions like the one I just described with Jordy Ben, and think they know what's going on. And their job is to be really informed in terms of the game itself. And their job is to talk about things, and their job is to ask all these questions and turn things into controversy. And we're all looped under this term media.
Yeah.
But we're not all the same roles. And I wish there was more to distinguish us. It's nothing bad about what those people do. That's what they're paid to do. And they're very good. Whether you like them or not. And they are the type of personalities that are kind of love, hate. Some people love them, some people hate them, but they're good at what they do. They do stimulate that discussion. They stimulate that conversation, and they really do know a lot about the game. Otherwise they wouldn't be in those positions to begin with. So they just, what they do is very different from what I do. And I'm not judging them for it. They're good at what they do, and I'm good at what I do. At least I think so. So
yes, you are.
Yes, Eric, you are.
That's more what it is. And I just think, you know, I don't remember what your specific tweet was, Veronica, but anybody who thinks that like the media wants to just tear Price down and this and that. And when I say the media for me is the people that are on the beat and the people that are actually involved with these people and know what's going on. None of them are looking to do anything that is totally unfair and totally, you know, they're just trying to do the job the best way they know how and do it in a fair way. And we all want, all of us would like better answers from Carey Price in the press conferences, but all of us also understand why he does what he does.
Yeah.
I'm not judging him for saying what he said. And I wish he would have had some sort of passionate, like, of course I care. Like, who the hell thinks that I don't care? And how could it not bother me? I would have loved that, but like, I do understand that Carey Price is Carey Price. He's not me. He's an introverted, sensitive to himself kind of person.
There's nothing he can say. If he would have said that, Eric, it would have been torn apart. Already with the answer that he did provide, all of us who were listening to him on the radio that day, it was immediately, he doesn't care. What if I told my boss that I don't care? He doesn't care about his job. And it was just like, oh my God, there's nothing.
Well, that's not what he said anyways,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
That's not what he said.
But
immediately it got twisted.
He had a passionate response like the one I was just talking about.
Yeah.
He'd be praised by some people for fighting back against that narrative. Other people would read into it and says, why should he give a shit what anybody else has to say? Like, this is ridiculous. Yeah,
exactly. Like,
how fragile is he mentally that he would actually care? And this, you know, because he can't care. Like, as much as he does personally, he still has to shut that out and focus on what matters. Because if he focuses on that, he's got no chance of recovering and being the player that he needs to be. Anyways, it's always that I think the fans in general, I was really happy someone asked me a question about that in my mailbag. Because the fans in general are missing kind of some of the pieces of the puzzle. And like, for every fan that's like you, Veronica, who doesn't want the media to pile on and like, it's enough with this shit and whatever, there's the other fan who says, why don't they ever ask tough questions? And why don't they call the coach? And why don't they ask, you know, like, why don't they ask about things that I would have done if I was the coach? And it's like, that's not our job. Like, that's not, I'm looking to fill the pieces of what I'm arguing. I'm asking a question specific to generate an answer that helps me construct or deconstruct an argument or fill a narrative. And sometimes I don't get that answer because A, I didn't ask the question in a way that it just came out of me perfectly. It just didn't. I asked the question of Dominic Ducharme the other day. He would have needed a codex to know what I was saying. Like, what is a codex? Anyways, I don't even know if that's the right word, but
it's close.
We know what you meant.
Yeah. Sometimes it doesn't come out the way I want it to. And I can't be there sitting writing down my questions because then I can't react to what's being said. And I can't, that's not who I am. And that's not what I'm ever going to do. And the other thing is like, just our job is not to cross-examine Mark Bergevin as though he is a murderer on trial for his life. our job is to get him to answer questions that we're curious about, that we have a plan that we're writing about, and to find out if what he says, and we're gonna use whatever he says to make our arguments, whether it's counter to what we're saying or whether it's that it feeds the argument that we're making. Like, I just think most people don't really understand why we're asking questions at certain times. And people that are like, you guys never ask the tough questions. I almost think to myself, like, do you watch the press conferences with Mark? It's not like sitting there having a Coke and smiling and just being like, this is great. This is,
a while back, we had John Liu on with us, and he had asked, I think that week, or earlier that week, he'd asked Mark Bergevin a question, and Mark kind of blew him off, and like, the people love John Liu, because why wouldn't you? But and people were like, why was he so rude to John Liu and like all this other stuff? And John Liu was like, that's how it goes. Like, we are just there to ask the questions. The best we can do is try. And I mean, I have been frustrated with people in the media with regard to players on the Montreal Canadiens, but people forget that all that they can do is try. And you've mentioned puzzles several times in the last few minutes, and it's like the questions are what help you find the puzzle pieces for what you're writing or whatever you're putting out. And people seem to forget that a lot of the time.
Like, I'll give you an example. Like, you're right. And I'll give you an example. Like, and in the Zoom atmosphere, by the way, we get one question post-game per person.
Mm-hmm.
And during practice days, we get two questions. But like, okay, the story of the game last night is they lose in a shootout. And in overtime, they aren't able to generate the type of offensive push they wanted to, even if they had a better strategy. And I may have found the puzzle pieces for different things and different answers that have already been given. And I'm saying to myself, I'm going to mention something about their power play in this article. I need one quote from somebody on the power play. So even though I'd rather ask Ducharme about why he started overtime again with Philippe Deneau, or to give that to the fans who are just like, ask him about Deneau, you know, like,
yeah.
I have one question to ask. And if I don't ask this question about the power play, another reporter might not. And then I don't have a quote that I need to make the point that I was going to make about how the power play is doing. Like, my whole article on Monday was about how they've had building blocks in place, and that this was like, there was all this positive that came out of a loss. And normally I'm not about moral victories, and I think that's all like garbage. But in this particular case, this is not one of those games that's going to discourage the Canadians, even though it's part of this losing pattern that's been a part of, even if they picked up points, they've lost more games than one. And recently, this is not one of the ones that will set back given the way they played it. So if I'm going to mention all the good things, I want to mention the penalty kill, which killed off a 5-on-3 and another penalty. I want to mention the power play, which scored a goal on one of two opportunities in that unit that's still doing great. And I want to mention the 5-on-5 kind of dominance for 59 minutes of the game. I have a quote from Deneau about the penalty kill. I have a quote from Petrie about the 5-on-5 play. I need a quote from Ducharme about the power play, which is why I'm not asking him about overtime. And maybe somebody else is. And so that's why, like, people say, oh, why didn't they ask about this and that? And this is how it actually works. And I just think it was great to have an opportunity to shed some light on that, not just in my column, but as we discuss it right now, you guys are three of you are fans. This is stuff that people really wouldn't know if we didn't tell them. Like, so it's, and there's space and room for the radio guys to do more of that kind of stuff if they really want some of those questions asked, where it's an obvious subject of the game that if I was a pure radio reporter and I wasn't just looking to fill a story, that I would be able to kind of hammer down. The other thing I didn't mention, by the way, is because everything is Zoom and everything is live broadcast and public and all this, you know, there's less value in me, say, putting Shea Weber on the spot about a bad game than if I were standing next to him and there wasn't 15 reporters next to us and I could have a conversation with him. And at one point during that conversation, I could say, so what were you doing on this play and why didn't it work? And because then it's not, I'm putting him on the spot in front of everyone and essentially just for the purpose of embarrassing him, because whatever answer he's going to give is going to be very protective of himself in that kind of atmosphere. So it's, you just got to realize, like, you got to pick your spot. There's a way to do this that the fans would never know because they don't know what that dynamic is of walking into the room every day and talking to these guys and getting to those real answers. And it sucks for us as reporters. We're missing that. I miss that so much. It's a huge part of how I've built the relationships that I've had and how I distinguish my voice from Arpin's or Marc-Antoine Godet's or Stu Cowan or whoever. We all have our different voices. We all cover the same material, you know, especially if we're focused on the right storylines. And, you know, this is a huge disadvantage that we have that we're dealing with, because let's face it, we're working, we're healthy, and we're not asking for much more right now, and that's okay.
Yeah. Right, right. Well, let's see here. We've had you on for a very good amount of time, and we're super happy about that. Veronica or Beth, did you have any other questions for Eric?
I had a question. And hopefully this will be a little more fun than the other things about you. I don't know if you noticed, but a lot of fans are very frustrated with the officiating and have been for several seasons, not just this season. The additional workload aside, how would you feel if referees and linesmen were added to the post-game media docket?
It's a great question, actually. There needs to be more accountability from the officials. I don't prescribe to the conspiracy theories within the Canadiens fan base that the refs are purposely shafting their team. But it's okay. Canadiens fan base is no different than any other fan base in that regard. There's a couple reasons why the Canadiens don't draw enough penalties. One of them is that calls are getting missed. The other is that, you know, they need to have a system, and I think they're trying to implement a system really where they do play a bit more on the inside of the ice. And that's where the main calls get made. And if they use their speed to their advantage, but there are some anomalies there that make it complicated. Like 5-on-5, they have some of the best numbers at generating shots from the high danger zone. And yet they're 27th in drawing penalties. It's not conspiratorial. It's not because I think the referee see a Canadiens jersey and won't make a call. I just don't know why it is that they're getting missed more often than they should. It happens both ways in a game, and fans freak out when I mention that someone deserves a penalty that they got. Like Paul Byron in Monday's game, full speed into Thatcher Demko. And yes, he tried to avoid him, but he still bumped into him at full speed in his crease. And he wasn't in control of the puck. He was reaching for a puck that he had brought in there. And yes, Quinn Hughes helped him into the goaltender after Byron lowered his shoulders in a leverage move to keep Quinn Hughes at bay. That's a penalty.
Textbook penalty.
How upset it made Canadiens fans that I pointed out that's a penalty. And they missed them on the Montreal Canadiens as much as they missed them on some of the other teams they're playing against. But it is odd to me that the Canadiens don't draw more of them given the 5-on-5 numbers. And the level of officiating does require more accountability, because I just can't understand how there's two guys wearing the stripes and the orange sleeves and two guys covering the lines and nobody seems to see what's happening. That's so obvious in plain sight. And the game, the closer you get to the game, obviously, if you've ever been a fan and sat up against the glass, or if you've ever taken a tour of the press box and watched it from up there, the closer you get to the game, the faster it moves. But man, like they have to be better. And the game is so fast that maybe that's the reason why they're not. The game is so fast that even with four of them out there and two of them able to call penalties, they're just missing some of them. And you know what? Like, I can't speak to the accountability factor in the other leagues. In hockey, it's always been that if you don't do the job well enough, you don't make it further along in the playoffs. I don't know if the refs are available for comment in the other leagues. I know that every NHL game has a supervisor who is particularly judging the referee's performance. And at one point, I remember this very distinctly. Game 6 with the Washington Capitals in 2010. Very bizarre night. And this was not a conspiracy against the Canadians, but some stuff went down in that game that was like, how could this be this bad with this much on the line? And what happened in that game was Brian Gionta got called for diving by himself.
Yes.
And Maxim LaPierre got called for two diving calls. And the penalty then this was game 6. This was a game that Halak made like 53 saves.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Won the game somehow, and it was just remarkable. But like diving that year in particular, like it was very, there may have been 6 instances the entire season where someone was called stand alone for a dive and not a trip going the other way as well as a coincidental minor. So it was like, I went to go see the supervisor, who was Kevin Collins, who's a longtime NHL linesman. And I said, what the hell happened tonight? Like, I've never seen that in my life. I've never seen, first of all, you're calling Brian Gionta for a dive by himself. He's getting called for that. And you have two other diving calls. And like, it's game 6 of a series where a team is down 3-2. And like, how could this be this bad in this situation? And like, the officiating was just horrible. And I remember him saying to me that like, if you think this bet was bad, like game 5 was even worse. And I didn't see a problem with those calls. And I'm just like,
oh,
horrible. So, oh. But you know, there's no public, you know, in a way they have to protect the officials. They are the targets for the fans and for people. They're targets for everyone. So I understand the policy of not making them publicly available. But there should be a bit more consequences in terms of their assignments and not just related to the playoffs. Mm-hmm. And that means developing more refs, and it means looking at the actual institution itself to see if they need to tweak the system. I don't feel that the system is any better with two officials on the ice than it was when there was one. And my personal opinion is I would take one off the ice and I would give all three officials that remain the ability to call the lines and the penalties. I happen to think that more often than not, the reason why there's four of them on the ice, a big part of it was to break up scrums, to help break up, you know, stuff that happens on the ice. I find a lot of the times there's so little space on the ice in terms of the game and the coverage that if they're not going to do a better job calling the penalties, you may as well take one of them off the ice because it's almost like one of them is always in the way. So it's, and let's face it, like fighting almost barely exists anymore. And the post-whistle scrums, you know, it doesn't generally lead to more fights. So I don't know. And I might not have the answer, and the officials may look at me and think I'm crazy for suggesting it to be that way. But I don't think the system is any better with two refs calling the penalties than it was when there was one. And if anything, they've eliminated some of the excuses they could be using for missing the amount of calls they make. So, or the amount of calls they miss. So, but I don't know if I'm for having the officials get into a press conference after the game and dissect how they made this mistake and that mistake, because it's a game of mistakes. And like there are, it's normal that they're going to miss things sometimes. It's just, it moves that fast and it's that hard to see everything, especially away from the puck. And even like one, there was one incident where Corey Perry took a high stick and a goal went
back. Oh,
yeah.
But like, you'll see in that sequence that the official is right next to Perry when it happens. But what mm-hmm. you want is that mm-hmm. he's turning right as the high stick happens, and he probably missed it. Like it happened right in front of his face, but his face was this way. Like, and it's easy to just look at it on a replay and say, how did he miss that? But it happens. So
like that,
they got to make it better.
Yeah. We are big proponents of making officiating better somehow, some way. And accountability was one of the things that we talk about pretty often and whatnot. Beth, that was an incredible question. I love that question so much, honestly. Veronica, do you have anything else for Eric?
I've asked my question, and thanks, Eric, for being so generous with your time. And also, thank you for reaching out to me and having a valuable conversation around the blanket term of media, because that's just a word that's just become common for fans every time we get frustrated or annoyed about anything that is hurting our players, that all we want them to do is win games. And so you and our friends John Liu and Arpan Basu and others who cover the team are fair. And we all, like I said in my tweet, we all know the ones who aren't, but you guys are fair and good, and we appreciate you. And thanks so much for being generous with your time tonight.
Yes, thank you so much.
I agree. Thank you, Eric. It's a lot of fun. Thank you so much.
It's a pleasure, guys, and I always enjoy the opportunity to talk to people and about what we do and how we do it. And you guys are passionate fans, and it's exciting to be a fan. And I think the best part about being a fan is you can be a fan however you want. You can be crazy and throw your remote at the TV and curse every player there, or you could be the ones who see no wrong or whatever it is. And as media, just know, the people that cover the team don't have an axe to grind. Like they literally just want to tell the truth about what they see, critical or in praise, and just tell it honestly and just be accountable to the people who they deal with. And that's what I try to do with the players. You know, I like that story with Jordy Ben. You know, I don't hide from the fact when I am critical of them. And I try to tell it both story. My whole existence is about telling the truth as I see it and telling the truth that's most representative of who these people are and how they view things. And the key to the whole job, in my view, is when I think about something that happened, whether it's on or off the ice, I try to think of it from the player's perspective. I try to think of it from the general manager's perspective, from the coach's perspective, from his teammates' perspective, from my perspective. I always am trying to keep a very global perspective of everything so that I can tell the truth that is most representative of what actually happened. And that's at the basis of journalism. It's how do we get to the real truth from every side and every angle, and how do we balance it, and how do we fair in what we're doing, what we're saying. And I think everybody that's on the beat is trying to do that. You know, whether they're successful in it or not is a long-term constant process, and we can all always get better. But it's an honest one, and no one is out there just trying to create a shitstorm. And like,
no, that's agreed.
So that's the way it works. And it was cool to talk to you guys about it.
Awesome. Thanks.
Thank you so much.
Well, if you wouldn't mind hanging out during our fade out, I'll just say bye to the listeners, and we can start the fade out. But really, Eric, it was really definitely a super pleasure to have you.